Today we're going to look at, as was mentioned, the book of Joshua. And this is a continuation of thoughts which began at the Vancouver Convention in June. In that study, we covered the first two chapters of Joshua. And today we will continue with the third chapter of Joshua and then try and get as far as we can. But before we start with this third chapter, there are two things that we have to do. First of all, we have to give you some background information on the book of Joshua itself. And then we have to summarize what has happened in the first two chapters that were already covered. And Joshua, of course, is one of the characters of the book. And I think it would be safe to say that he is the main character. Out of over 1 million people who left Egypt with Moses during the Exodus, only Joshua and Caleb entered the promised land. All the others who originally started out died during the 40-year journey in the wilderness, leaving only their children to enter the promised land. Joshua and Caleb, we remember, were the part of that group of 12 spies that Moses sent on a reconnaissance trip 39 years earlier. They were the only two of the 12 that trusted God and brought back a positive report to Moses and their people. However, the other 10 did not trust God, and they came back and gave a false, exaggerated report, which frightened their brethren and caused them to refuse to enter Canaan. And as a result, God did not allow them to enter the land, but made them wander in the wilderness until the disobedient generation had all died. The purpose of the book of Joshua is to give the history of Israel's conquest of the promised land. The setting of the book is mainly Canaan, also called the promised land, which occupied the same general geographical territory of modern-day Israel. The key people in the book are Joshua, Rahab, Achan, Phinehas, and Eleazar. The main themes of the book are success, faith, guidance, leadership, and conquest. And we will briefly discuss each of these main themes at this point. The first one, success, came to the Israelites when God gave it to them, when they obeyed his plan and not their own desires. Victory came only when they trusted in God, rather than in their own military power, wealth, muscle, or mental capacity. The second theme is faith. And faith was demonstrated by the Israelites when they trusted God daily to save and guide them. By noticing how God fulfilled his promises in the past, they developed strong confidence that he would be faithful in the future. The third theme, guidance, was given to Israel by God for every aspect of their lives. His law guided them in their daily living. His orders gave them victory in battle. The fourth theme is leadership, and leadership was modeled by Joshua. He was confident in God's strength. He was courageous in the face of opposition, and he was willing to seek God's advice. And the fifth theme is conquest. Conquest was commanded by God. He wanted his people, Israel, to conquer the Canaanites and take all their land. Completing this mission would have fulfilled God's promise to Abraham and brought judgment on the people living there. Unfortunately, Israel never finished the job. So now that we know a little bit about the book of Joshua, let's review the first two chapters that we already covered in brief. Joshua had been chosen as Israel's new leader following Moses' death. He was well qualified in the following ways. Firstly, Numbers 27:13-23 tells us that God appointed him. Secondly, he was one of only two living eyewitnesses to the Egyptian plagues and the Exodus. And thirdly, he was Moses' personal aide for 40 years. And lastly, Only he and Caleb believed that God would help them conquer the land. So off Joshua went to lead more than 2 million people into a strange new land to conquer it. God assured Joshua that he would be with him at every step of the way if he fulfilled 3 requirements. He had to be strong and courageous. He had to be obedient to God's law. And he had to constantly read and study the book of instruction, God's word. Before leaving on their military campaign, Joshua did 2 very important things. Firstly, he called the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh together and reminded them of their obligation to lead the other tribes in battle when they crossed the Jordan. They had been given land by Moses on the east side of the Jordan with the understanding that if they were given that land on the east side, they would help their brethren obtain land on the west side of the Jordan. That meant leaving their flocks, herds, women and children behind while they went off to lead their brethren into battle with the understanding that once the land was taken, then they could return to their livestock and families on the east side of the Jordan. The second thing of importance that Joshua did before they left was to send 2 spies into Canaan, specifically the Jericho region, to survey the situation. And this is where Rahab comes into the picture. These 2 spies entered Jericho and chose to stay at her house. Now, why would they choose to stay in the house of a harlot? Well, firstly, it was a good place to gather information with no questions asked. Secondly, her house was built spanning the 2 walls of the city, with a window opening to the outside of the outer wall. But most importantly, God knew Rahab's heart was open to him and that she would help. Despite her profession and the fact that she was a Canaanite, her faith and trust in God showed that she recognized something that many of the Israelites did not, that the God of heaven is all-powerful. And God, in return, in his wisdom, provided for her and her family. And in due time, Rahab married a man named Salmon, and they had a son named Boaz, who then married Ruth, and they became great-grandparents of King David, which in turn led eventually to Jesus, the promised Messiah, and the Lamb of God. Only God could have known that Rahab, the harlot of Jericho, and the woman that let down the scarlet cord, would someday be in the ancestral line of the very one in whose blood she symbolically trusted. From this encounter, 2 important things happened. The spies were told by Rahab that the Canaanites were terrified of the Israelites because God was with them. Rahab secured safety and salvation for herself and her family by promising not to betray the spies and hiding them, and then letting them down from her window by a scarlet rope. And this scarlet rope was to be left hanging from the window to signify that her house was to be spared by the invading army. The scarlet rope also had great significance as a foreshadow of God's payment for sin, the blood of our Lord Jesus. The spies returned to Joshua with a favorable report. Joshua had sent them in secret because he knew only too well what a disaster a poor report might cause. Also, Joshua didn't want the other leaders to criticize him, yet he needed that information so that they could move ahead confidently. As we start chapter 3 of Joshua, the Israelites are about to cross the Jordan. As we read verses 1 to 6, early the next morning, Joshua and all the Israelites left Acacia Grove and arrived at the banks of the Jordan River, where they camped before crossing. 3 days later, the Israelite officers went through the camp, giving these instructions to the people. When you see the Levitical priests carrying the Ark of the covenant of the Lord your God, move out from your positions and follow them. Since you have never traveled this way before, they will guide you. Stay about a half mile behind them, keeping a clear distance between you and the ark. Make sure you don't come any closer. Then Joshua told the people, purify yourselves for tomorrow. The Lord will do great wonders among you. And in the morning, Joshua said to the priests, lift up the Ark of the Covenant and lead the people across the river. And so they started out and went ahead of the people. Now the Ark of the Covenant was Israel's most sacred treasure. It was a symbol of God's presence and power. And the Ark was a rectangular box made of acacia wood and covered with gold, with two cherubim or angels facing each other on the lid. Inside the Ark were the tablets of the Ten Commandments Moses received from God, a jar of manna, the bread God miraculously sent from heaven during the wilderness wanderings, and Aaron's staff, the symbol of the high priest's authority. Now the tablets of the Ten Commandments signified the character and the nature of God. The manna was a dew-like white substance that tasted like honey, and the Israelites quickly tired of it and complained that it didn't compare to the wonderful food they were accustomed to having in Egypt. However, the manna was meant to simply sustain them in their journey and never to satisfy. Is there a picture in this? I kind of think so. Aaron's rod represents the power of God. The Israelite leaders were dissatisfied with the leadership of Moses and came complaining as usual, thinking they could do a better job. They were asked to each bring their staff to Moses, and he placed the staffs in the Lord's presence in the tabernacle. When Moses went into the tabernacle the next day, he found that Aaron's staff, representing the tribe of Levi, had sprouted, budded, blossomed, and produced ripe almonds. The Lord then said to Moses, place Aaron's staff permanently before the Ark of the Covenant as a warning to rebels. Now, according to God's law, only the Levites could carry the Ark, and the Ark was constructed at the same time as the tabernacle, according to Exodus 37, verses 1 to 9, and placed in the sanctuary's most sacred room. Before entering the Promised Land, the Israelites were to perform a purification ceremony, and this was often done before making a sacrifice or, as in this case, before witnessing a great act of God. God's law stated that a person could become unclean for many reasons: eating certain foods, Leviticus 11, giving birth, Leviticus 12, dealing with disease, Leviticus 13 and 14, touching a dead person, Numbers 19, 11 to 22. And God used these various outward signs of uncleanliness to illustrate a person's inward uncleanliness that comes, as a result of sin. The purification ceremony pictured the importance of approaching God with a pure heart. We will now continue reading the third chapter of Joshua, verses 7 to 17. And the Lord told Joshua, today I will make you a great leader in the eyes of all the Israelites. They will know that I am with you, just as I was with Moses. Give this command to the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant. When you reach the banks of the Jordan River, take a few steps into the river and stop there. So Joshua told the Israelites, come and listen to what the Lord your God says. Today you will know that the living God is among you. He will surely drive out the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites ahead of you. Look, the Ark of the Covenant, which belongs to the Lord of the whole earth, will lead you across the Jordan. Now, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. The priests will carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth. And as soon as their feet touch the water, the flow of the water will be cut off upstream, and the river will stand up like a wall. So the people left their camp to cross the Jordan, and the priests who were carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. It was the harvest season, and the Jordan was overflowing its banks. But as soon as the feet of the priests who were carrying the Ark touched the water at the river's edge, the water above that point began backing up a great distance away at a town called Adam, which is near Zarethan. And the water below that point flowed on to the Dead Sea until the riverbed was dry. Then all the people crossed over near the town of Jericho. Meanwhile, the priests who were carrying the Ark of the Lord's Covenant stood on dry ground in the middle of the riverbed as the people passed by. And they waited there until the whole nation of Israel had crossed the Jordan on dry ground. Now, just before crossing over into the Promised Land, Joshua gathered the people to hear the words of the Lord. And we can be sure that their excitement was high. Here they were, no doubt wanting to rush on because here was the land that God had promised them and that they had waited so long for. But there was Joshua saying, "Just a moment. God wants us to stop and listen. We all live in a fast-paced age where everyone has to rush just to keep up. And it is so easy to get caught up in our everyday lives and become so busy that we have no time to listen to God's directions for the day. Taking the time to listen to God's direction can most often help us and also help us to avoid foolish mistakes in most instances. Now, why would God help the Israelites drive out these nations from their native land? Well, we know that God had already punished Israel first for its disobedience. He then turned to the rest of the nations. And in Genesis 15 and 16, he implies that the people of Canaan were wicked and deserved to be punished for their sins. Israel was to be a vehicle for this punishment. More important was the fact that Israel was a holy nation and could not live among such evil and idolatrous people. To do so would be to invite sin into their lives. And the only way for Israel to not be infected by evil religions was to drive out those who practiced them. And Israel, however, failed to do what God had told them to do. And as a result, it wasn't long before Israel, the nation that God chose to be his holy people, began following the evil practices of the Canaanites. Now we can only imagine how eager they were to enter the Promised Land and to conquer nations and to live peacefully. After all, this is what God had promised. But first they had to cross the flood level waters of the Jordan. And God gave them specific instructions. In order to cross, the priests had to step into the water. They had to have the courage to take that first step. And that courage always comes from our faith in God. Often God provides no solution to our problems until we trust him and move ahead with what we know we should do and take that first step forward. God had parted the waters of the Red Sea to let the people out of Egypt in Exodus 14. And here he parted the Jordan River to let them enter Canaan. These miracles showed Israel that God keeps his promises. And God's presence among his people and his faithfulness to them made the entire journey from Egypt to the Promised Land possible. He was with them at the end of their wanderings, just as he was with them in the beginning. The Israelites crossed the Jordan River in the spring when it was overflowing its banks. And God chose this time when the river was at its highest to demonstrate his power, parting the water so that the entire nation could cross on dry ground. Now, there's some speculation that God used a natural occurrence, such as an earthquake, to cause a landslide, which blocked the Jordan River near the town of Adam for a sufficient period of time to allow the crossing. Others say that he did it by a direct act. The truth of the matter is that it isn't really important as to how it was done. God showed his great power by working a miracle of timing and location to allow his people to cross the river on dry ground. And this testimony of God's supernatural power served to build the Israelites' faith in God and to give them a great reputation with their enemies, who greatly outnumbered them. We will now read verses 1 to 11 of chapter 4. When all the people had crossed the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, "Now choose 12 men, one from each tribe. Tell them, take 12 stones from the very place where the priests are standing in the middle of the Jordan. Carry them out and pile them up at the place where you will camp tonight." So Joshua called together the 12 men he had chosen, one from each of the tribes of Israel. He told them, "Go into the middle of the Jordan, in front of the ark of the Lord your God. Each of you must pick up one stone and carry it out on your shoulder. 12 stones in all, one for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. We will use these stones to build a memorial. In the future, your children will ask you, 'What do these stones mean?' Then you can tell them, 'They remind us that the Jordan River stopped flowing when the ark of the Lord's covenant went across.' These stones will stand as a memorial among the people of Israel forever." So the men did as Joshua had commanded them. They took 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan River, one for each tribe, just as the Lord had told Joshua. They carried them to the place where they camped for the night and constructed the memorial there. Joshua also set up another pile of 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan at the place where the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant were standing. And the priests who were carrying the Ark stood in the middle of the river until all of the Lord's commands that Moses had given to Joshua were carried out. Meanwhile, the people hurried across the riverbed, and when everyone was safely on the other side, the priests crossed over with the Ark of the Lord as the people watched. Now, crossing the Jordan safely was the first step towards conquering the Promised Land. But God once again slowed the Israelites down with his instruction when he directed them to build a memorial with the 12 stones that were carried up out of the river. Building this memorial to the Israelites was a reminder to future generations of when the river stopped flowing and the Ark of the Lord's Covenant went across. However, it also served the purpose of directing their attention to God and his power that was displayed on their behalf. God wanted them to remember who was guiding them, so he kept slowing them down with tasks that brought their attention back to him. And we too, from time to time, need to be slowed down and reminded who gives us the power to do the tasks at hand. Let us continue reading from Joshua chapter 4, verses 12 to 24. The armed warriors from the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh led the Israelites across the Jordan, just as Moses had directed. These armed men, about 40,000 strong, were ready for battle, and the Lord was with them as they crossed over to the plains of Jericho. That day, the Lord made Joshua a great leader in the eyes of all the Israelites, and for the rest of his life, they revered him as much as they revered Moses. The Lord had said to Joshua, "Command the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant to come out of the riverbed." So Joshua gave the command. And as soon as the priests carrying the Ark of the Lord's Covenant came up out of the riverbed and their feet were on high ground, the water of the Jordan returned and overflowed its banks as before. The people crossed the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month. Then they camped at Gilgal, just east of Jericho. And it was there at Gilgal that Joshua piled up the 12 stones taken from the Jordan River. Then Joshua said to the Israelites, "In the future, your children will ask, 'What do these stones mean?' And you can tell them that this is where the Israelites crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the river right before your eyes, and he kept it dry until you were all across, just as he did at the Red Sea when he dried it up, until we had all crossed over. And he did this so that the nations of the earth might know that the Lord's hand is powerful, and so you might fear the Lord your God forever. Let us now look at the fifth chapter of Joshua, chapters 1 to 15. And when all the Amorite kings west of the Jordan, and all the Canaanite kings who lived along the Mediterranean coast heard how the Lord had dried up the Jordan River so the people of Israel could cross, they lost heart, and they were paralyzed with fear because of them. At that time, the Lord told Joshua, "Make flint knives and circumcise the second generation of Israelites." So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the entire male population of Israel at Gibeah, Haraloth. And Joshua had to circumcise them because all the men who were old enough to fight in battle when they left Egypt had died in the wilderness. And those who left Egypt had all been circumcised, but none of those born after the Exodus during the years in the wilderness had been. And the Israelites had traveled in the wilderness for 40 years until all the men who were old enough to fight in the battle when they left Egypt had died. For they had disobeyed the Lord, and the Lord vowed he would not let them enter the land he had sworn to give them, a land flowing with milk and honey. So Joshua circumcised their sons, those who had grown up to take their father's places, for they had not been circumcised on the way to the promised land. And after all the males had been, they rested in the camp until they were healed. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the shame of your slavery in Egypt." So that place has been called Gilgal to this day. And while the Israelites were camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, they celebrated Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the first month. The very next day they began to eat unleavened bread and roasted grain harvested from the land. No manna appeared on the day they first ate from the crops of the land, and it was never seen again. So from that time on, the Israelites ate from the crops of Canaan. And when Joshua was near the town of Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with sword in hand. And Joshua went up to him and demanded, "Are you friend or foe?" "Neither one," he replied. "I am the commander of the Lord's army." And at this Joshua fell with his face to the ground in reverence. "I am at your command," Joshua said. "What do you want your servant to do?" "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did as he was told. Now the Amorites and the Canaanites were the two major groups living in Canaan at the time of Israel's invasion. And the Canaanites worshipped a variety of gods, but Baal was their favorite. Canaanite culture was materialistic, and their religion was sensual. And the Israelites continually turned to Baal after entering Canaan. The Amorite gods also infected Israel's worship and turned people away from worshiping the true God. And worshiping these false gods eventually brought about Israel's downfall. The Israelites spent 39 years in the wilderness unnecessarily because they were terrified of the Canaanites. They underestimated God's ability. The Israelites' first attempt to enter the promised land had failed in Numbers 13 and 14. But now the Canaanites had heard about Israel's great victories through God, and they were terrified. They were hoping that the flooded Jordan would slow Israel down, or maybe even discourage them from entering Canaan. But their courage melted as soon as the news came that the Israelites had crossed the Jordan on dry land. They knew that God was on Israel's side. The rite of circumcision marked Israel's position as God's covenant people. When God made the original covenant with Abraham, he required that each male be circumcised as a sign of cutting off the old life and beginning a new life with God, Genesis 17 and 13. Other cultures at that time used circumcision as a sign of entry into adulthood, but only Israel used it as a sign of following God. Gilgal, which was located about 2 miles northeast of Jericho, was Israel's base camp and their temporary center of government and worship during their invasion of Canaan. And at Gilgal, the angelic commander of the Lord's army appeared to Joshua with further instructions for battle and encouragement for their conquest. And Gilgal was also the place where Israel's first king Saul was crowned. The first Passover celebrated in the Promised Land took place in Gilgal. It was also only the third Passover celebrated by Israel since the Exodus from Egypt. The last time they had celebrated the Passover was at the foot of Mount Sinai, 39 years earlier. And this celebration reminded Israel of God's mighty miracles that brought them out of Egypt. There they had to eat in haste. Here they ate in celebration of God's blessings and promises. God supplied manna to the hungry Israelites during the 40 years of wandering, and in the Promised Land, this manna was no longer necessary, because the land was ready for planting and harvesting. And God had miraculously provided food for the Israelites while they were in the wilderness. Here, He provided food from the land itself. Prayer is not an alternative to preparation, and faith is not a substitute for hard work. God can and does provide miraculously for His people as needed, but He also expects them to use their God-given talents and resources to provide for themselves. In other words, God helps those who help themselves. Joshua had an angel appear to him who stated he was the commander of the Lord's army. As a sign of respect, Joshua took off his sandals. And although Joshua was Israel's leader, he was still subordinate to God, who is our absolute leader. Awe and respect are the responses we should have for our God. We can show our respect for God by our attitudes and actions. God's power, authority, and deep love for us should be recognized by us through our actions and attitudes. Our culture no longer takes off shoes as a sign of